When I come to the beach here in Santa Monica, California, I'm always struck with the exact same thoughts from up here on the cliffs, looking down at the ocean, pondering what it must have looked like during the various geological ages, especially during the Pleistocene, or Ice Age, when global sea levels were 400 feet lower than they are now, about 16,000 years ago. All that water was trapped as glaciers and ice, which is why it was called the Ice Age, when parts of Northern Europe and places like Canada were under 2 miles of ice. This becomes especially fascinating to me when I read mythology about ancient civilizations and races of people that may have once inhabited the poles back when it was more hospitable, before things abruptly changed on planet Earth. Of course, academia ignores places like the Arctic and Antarctica for that matter, as there are no monkeys there presently to link humanity to, and so they focus on finding their imaginary missing links. But politically motivated Afrocentric fairy tales have not always been the dominant theory for humanity's origins. In his 1885 book called Paradise Found, The Cradle of the Human Race at the North Pole, William Fairfield Warren placed Hyperborea, as well as Atlantis, Eden, Mount Meru, Yggdrasil, and Avalon in the Arctic region. He was convinced that the Garden of Eden itself was at the North Pole. Warren proposed that all these fabled lands that are now mostly remembered as mere myth are folk memories of a far northern domain, inhabited long ago, and from which civilization first emerged and then diffused south. Following in the footsteps of Homer, Virgil, and Hesiod, Warren placed the primordial Titan Atlas of Greek mythology, or his world pillar, at the ends of the earth, meaning the far northern Arctic regions. He equated Atlas, who supported the heavens on his shoulders, or the earth on a pillar, with the Atlas described by Plato as the first ruler of Atlantis. Another scholar that investigated ancient mythology was Bal Gangadhar Tilak, a very important and revered spiritual and political leader of India from 1880 to 1920. He was also a mathematician, astronomer, historian, journalist, philosopher, and regarded as the father of the Indian independence movement. In his book, The Arctic Home in the Vedas, written at the end of 1898, Tilak theorized that the North Pole was the original home of the Aryans during the pre-glacial period, and that they had to leave due to the ice deluge. In support of his theory, Tilak points to certain Vedic hymns, Avestic passages, Vedic chronology, and Vedic calendars, which all describe ancient Aryan migrations from the Arctic to Northern Europe and Asia in search of lands for new settlements. Tilak believed that further study of Vedic hymns and Avestic passages revealed the long journey of primitive Aryan antiquity in the north. In the words of Bal Gangadhar Tilak, quote, "It followed, therefore, that if the Vedic evidence pointed to an Arctic home, the forefathers of the Aryan race must have lived therein not after, but before the last glacial epoch." End quote. According to Tilak, after the destruction of the original Arctic home by the last ice age, the Aryan survivors roamed the northern parts of Europe and Asia in search of land suitable for new settlements. The geography of land and water on the Earth during the interglacial period was quite different from what it is today. The coming of the glacial age destroyed the genial climate and rendered the regions unsuited for habitation by tropical plants and fauna. One needs only to examine the flash frozen carcasses of mammoth found in the Arctic with still undigested semi-tropical vegetation in their stomachs, that is, plants that are no longer found in the Arctic, to understand that the climate changed very abruptly and catastrophically as far as the habitation was concerned. A map originally published in 1570 by Abraham Ortelius of Amsterdam is called the Theatrum Orbis Terrarum and is considered to be the first true modern atlas. The North Polar Inset map presents a central continent of Hyperborea or Hyperborea at the Arctic region. Many of the maps in this atlas were based upon sources that no longer exist or are extremely rare. Gerardus Mercator's maps were among the earliest to display the Arctic as a composition drawn from classical and Nordic sources. Mercator was a cartographer and mathematician born in what is now Belgium. He developed the Mercator Projection World Map, which is still in use today. Mercator left us his map from the 16th century, the first to offer an image of the Arctic as sourced from a now lost 14th century book, The Itinerarium of Jacob Nguyen. Such a large, exposed landmass likely does not exist today as depicted, but remnants of it might. What Mercator and other cartographers of his time were showing, probably unknowingly, was an Arctic landmass that existed there many thousands of years ago in antediluvian times. The back of the map gives insight about this ancient land. Its location is described as, and I quote, an extreme region of the north whose apex in the firmament is the North Pole. For this reason, half of the year is one and the same miraculous day, the other half continuous night. There are mountains covered by eternal snows, untouched by the heat of summer, forests without trails, rare animals, and roaring rivers within the abyss of crags. Strange tribes also reside there, and it is known that an immeasurably rich forest troll named Memming has lived there at one point. The weight of these creatures is so filled with insuperable difficulties that a mortal has difficult time getting there. The largest part of the journey is cloaked with an incredibly deep layer of snow. Anyone intending to traverse it must use a conveyance pulled by harnessed reindeer. End quote. Just as Plato wrote about the mythical Atlantis, a continent which was said to be once located above sea level in the Atlantic, Herodotus wrote about the legendary Hyperborean continent, which he said once existed in the far north. This map not only depicts what could very well be the remnants of Hyperborea, but it also seems to imply that a race of pygmies once heavily populated the northern Canadian and Arctic regions where the four rivers intersect. Written on the map, Mercator explains that the ocean waters rush inward towards the center, between the islands to the pole, where they plunge deep into the earth. Directly at the pole is a black island, 33 leagues in circumference. The converging four rivers are rumored to be, at least partially, driven by powerful magnetic currents along the Earth's main meridian lines, which circle the entire globe, dividing it into four quarters. On one of the large islands featured in the center of the Arctic map, it is clearly written in the legend, and I translate, "Here live pygmies, at most 4 feet tall, who are like those called Skraelings in Greenland." Who are these people that are mentioned with a supposed height of merely 4 feet, and where did they come from? Olaus Magnus describes the pygmies of Greenland as small in stature, but big of heart. Skraeling is the Norse word for the various natives of the Arctic and the New World, including the mainland native Indians, the Dorset people of the islands, and the Eskimos who replaced the Dorsets in the early second millennium. The word pygmy derives from the Greek word for a unit of measurement called cubit. The pygmies of antiquity were believed to be a cubit or two in height, which is 18 to 36 inches. Pliny the Elder tells us that, quote, beyond these, in the most outlying number region, we are told of the three-span men and pygmies, who do not exceed three spans, 27 inches in height. The climate is healthy and always spring-like, as it is protected on the north by a range of mountains. This tribe, Homer has also recorded as being beset by cranes. Homer's Iliad mentions the terrible and violent war between the large deadly cranes and the valiant and courageous pygmies. He compares the bloody battles of the Greeks and Trojans to the ferocity of the tireless battles between pygmy and crane. Pliny the Elder noted that the pygmies were believed to have been displaced from their ancestral home by the crane's unrelenting onslaught. He locates a remaining population of pygmies somewhere mainly between Egypt and Ethiopia, though also having found a refuge as far afield as the southeast of the North American continent. Arab scholars agree with the 14th century Italian missionary and explorer Friar Orderic about the tales told in China concerning remnant populations of pygmy struggling to survive against the continued predations of angry cranes in the Himalayas. Chinese annals record similar accounts. According to the most ancient records from the Chinese, Scandinavians, Greeks, Romans, Arabs, and Cherokee, we have an undeniable collective memory of an ancient, millennium-long, and worldwide pygmy versus crane war, resulting in victory for the crane and the near total extinction of the pygmy. The pygmies were eventually fractured, reduced to refugee status, and forced into exile. Small clusters of them settled in Egypt, Ethiopia, Arctic Canada, and the Himalayas in an attempt to flee from the unstoppable cranes, who seemed determined to pursue them to the ends of the earth. In a 2010 article for Live Science called Giant Storks May Have Fed on Real Hobbits, Charles Choi describes fossils of giant storks found in Southeast Asia, which could provide empirical evidence supporting the ancient myth of the pygmy battles. Perhaps the role of the stork in the way early populations were introduced to each other has been largely forgotten or filed away as myth. Which brings us to this very rare and special map printed in 1740 by Matthias Suter, one of the most important and prolific German map publishers of the 18th century. It is of Schlaraffenland, which is a land of milk and honey, a map of a German concept of utopia. The original map from which this engraving was made was supposedly dropped off at Mr. Suter's map shop, left right outside of his door, mysteriously just left there with no further information about it. For those interested, I go into more detail about this in my book called Gods with Amnesia. That said, this map is not of any known landmass on the surface of the earth, and has peculiar writing on it, such as saying the light is the same both day and night. I would like to now draw your attention to the bottom right-hand portion of the map, which I found extraordinarily interesting. The writing on it says, in German, and I'll translate, a utopian map of the newly discovered Schlaraffenland. This land was often spoken of, but never located, and nobody knows where it is. This ridiculous fantasy land is composed of many kingdoms, which have all the different vices of life within them, and that this map was delivered by anonymous authors. Could this so-called fantasy map in actuality be giving us a clue as to the polar entrance to the inner earth, which piqued the interest of nationalist Germany in the early part of the last century? As you can see, the writing is on what appears to be a large rock, or a mountain, with four rivers running into it. Does this remind you of the Mercator map we examined at the start of this video? Could this map be a portion of the inner world? There are numerous myths and legends regarding entrances to inhabited subterranean worlds at the poles, most taken very seriously by European secret societies of the 19th and 20th centuries. Probably my favorite story is called The Smoky God, which I'll cover in its own video soon, but is available to read for free online, and I highly recommend it. That said, I'd like to focus on some other myths relating to an ancient legendary race with a small stature. Murphy, North Carolina is a town in Cherokee County situated where the Hiwassee and Valley Rivers meet, about 360 miles from the capital of Raleigh. With a population of just under 2,000 people, this small town is home to one of the most interesting mysteries from a time before the first Thanksgiving. Believed to be centuries old, this 3-foot-tall soapstone sculpture of conjoined figures went on display at the Cherokee County Historical Museum in 2015, after decades of being hidden away in private hands since first being discovered in the 1840s in Murphy, North Carolina. The two-headed figure with big round eyes looks like nothing else ever found in the Southeast, and are believed to depict the moon-eyed people, a race of small people that, according to Cherokee legend, were blinded by daylight but able to see in the moonlight. The moon-eyed people were said to only come out at night, described as light-skinned with big blue eyes. There are several theories as to who the legends could be about, with one popular being that they're actually the Melungeons, descendants of Welsh adventurers who supposedly landed in Alabama in 1170 AD. Now, I'm not a big fan of this theory and believe that the term Melungeon, which first appeared in print in the 19th century, simply describes people of a mixed ancestry of European, Native American, and African ethnicity in the Southeast United States. That said, another theory is that the pygmy-sized statues may or may not be of moon-eyed people, but in fact were of what are known as little people, who were said to cry tears that turned into fairy crosses or stone cross-shaped artifacts, which are also on display at the museum. I write about this extensively in my book, Gods with Amnesia, and have already covered the subject of this mysterious ancient pygmy race in a prior video, so I don't want to be redundant. But according to the Cherokee legends, the moon-eyed people were a separate race of physically small troglodytes found inhabiting the earth at the same moment that they were, in a time before Columbus arrived in the Americas. And while there are variations of the myth, they all seem to end in the expulsion of this mysterious race to a life lived exclusively underground. One legend finds the moon-eyed people driven from their home by the Creek tribe from the south. The story goes that the Creek waited until the light of the full moon became too bright for even the nocturnal cave dwellers to face, ambushed them in their time of weakness, and drove them from their homeland further into the underground caves. Another account sees the Cherokee people themselves fighting the moon-eyed people towards the west into what is now Tennessee. And a more recent theory speculates that the moon-eyed people may have sought refuge further north in what is now West Virginia.
For years, stories have been passed down about Cherokee little people.
As legend has it, they lived underground. News 13's Rex Hodge joins us from the Western News Center.
Rex, a local author, has a new book out about these little people. Does she believe they exist?
She does. Mary Joyce's book is called Cherokee Little People Were Real, and she says there's evidence to prove it.
My giant curiosity. I mean, little people that nobody seemed to know about.
Mary Joyce started collecting notes more than a decade ago about legends of little people in our western mountains, finally putting out a book. Cherokee Little People Were Real.
They were here before the Cherokee.
She says the Cherokee came from the Great Lakes region thousands of years ago, arriving to find little people who lived underground.
Would tend their gardens at nighttime. by the moonlight, and originally the Cherokee called them the Moon People.
And she says the Cherokee adopted them. Joyce bases much of her book on the recollections of two men who grew up hearing Little People stories, claiming to have seen evidence, including tunnels near older buildings at Western Carolina University, like the McKee Building, built in the 30s.
And these tunnels, I guess, were like a network.
And they do really believe that these things do exist, and they're only about 2 feet tall when they're fully grown.
Cherokee history lecturer Freeman Owl has spoken to Eastman's classes about the Little People. He says many Cherokee believe in them and their existence.
Reporting live tonight from the Western News Center, Rex Hodge, News 13.
The Cherokees said that when they moved into these southern Appalachian mountains, they were already a race of people here. And they were short, white, flat-faced, and blue-eyed. They were so blue-eyed that they couldn't see to work in the sunshine. So they'd come out of an evening and night to do their work. And so the Cherokees called them the moon-eyed people. Now, we know that there's an Indian village down there because there was a small mound where they had the council house, supposedly where these were kept, to show the subsequent generations, you know, the people that they displaced by the Cherokees. Now, we know that the Moon-Eyed people lived down there, or pretty sure they did, because in their oral tradition, they said that they lived at the, where they were afraid to cross the creek, which we think would have been Valley River because it was smaller than Hiawassee. And the reason that they were afraid to cross the creek was because of the big red leech. And that universally accepted Cherokee myth and legend is about the big red leech hole down there. You know, that's in their all their oral traditions. Now, the question is, where did they come from?
The concept of a subterranean people living in the Americas strikes up similarities to another story that is also found in my books and included in a prior video, and that is of the Hopi Indians, who themselves claim to have emerged from the inside of the earth rather than on ships from either Europe or Asia, or even the north as suggested by mainstream anthropologists. Unfortunately, deep exploration of most cave systems, especially in the Grand Canyon, is strictly forbidden, as is genetic testing on any ancient remains found in North America. And so the myths and legends remain a mystery, and nothing is allowed except the force-fed, genetically debunked, politically motivated propaganda known as the Out of Africa Hypothesis, which I'm confident will go down in history as an even bigger hoax than the fraud known as the Piltdown Man, where a baboon's jaw was glued to a human cranium and touted as the missing link by the British Museum for the first half of the 20th century. Talk about a real fairy tale. Situated off the north coast of Great Britain, part of the Northern Isles of Scotland, is where we find Orkney, which is made up of 70 islands, of which 20 are inhabited, with habitation stretching back at least 8,500 years. The largest island is called the Mainland, with an area of about 200 square miles, and was once home to a forgotten people that history refers to as the Picts, a confederation of Celtic-speaking peoples who left behind stone monuments inscribed with symbolic designs which predated Christianity. It was the Roman Empire that spread Christianity into southern Britain, and the Picts were their enemies, and considered them as an occupying force. That said, the Romans never fully occupied northern Scotland, and most of what we know about the Picts comes from Roman sources, so it's largely biased. They did, however, conquer the British island through religion, using British mercenaries, and this is expressed in the story of St. Patrick, the patron saint of Ireland, who drove out the snakes, a creature which never inhabited Ireland, and is symbolic for the people now largely regarded as pagans. I cover this in a video on St. Patrick, which I will leave a link to in the description for those that are interested and missed it. Much of the real Irish, Scottish, and even British history has been lost and is no longer taught, but parts remain in myth and legend, such as the Tuatha De Danann, which I also cover, and will leave a link to a video in the description. And while I'm at it, I'll include a link to a presentation I did on how Scotland got its name. It's titled, An Old Irish Legend About an Ancient Egyptian Princess. So if you take the time to watch it, please share your thoughts with me in the comment section, as I also learn a lot from the feedback I receive on these videos. That said, in today's episode, we will go back in time to an era before the Picts, which incidentally is not what they called themselves, but was a name given to them by the Romans that means painted or tattooed, likely blue and red, like the word Phoenician from the Greek word phoinos, meaning red, or the tribe of Dan whose color was red and whose symbol was the snake. The Phoenicians invaded Britain over 3,000 years ago, and they wanted tin to mix with copper to make bronze, and they mixed with the indigenous people there, the original Picts, who were short-statured, dark-haired, round and broad-headed, which in anthropological terms is called brachycephalic. And it is this pre-Phoenician ancient race or phenotype that we will explore today. Long before Stonehenge, or even most of the Egyptian pyramids were built, a thriving village existed in Scotland. One day, a farmer on the island of Orkney found a large stone that didn't look like it belonged in its environment. When the farmer flipped over the stone, he was shocked at what he discovered underneath. Skara Brae, a hidden and lost village that existed over 5,000 years ago. The farmer thought it was a house at first, because it looked rather small to be a village, but when it was active, it was home to over 100 people, which might not seem like a lot, but back then it was, considering the population density was much lower. The village, or tiny city, was well preserved for thousands of years, as it was covered with sand. I know some of my subscribers will compare this to Göbekli Tepe, the 10,000-year-old site in modern-day Turkey, whose large stone monuments were also buried and well-preserved. But the difference is that Göbekli Tepe was purposely buried, and Skara Brae got covered by sand dunes either rapidly over time, but it wasn't intentional. In any event, these buried homes were not just used as shelters for its citizens, but the center of each home contained a waterproof basin, which some archaeologists believe was used to catch fish in, but there are other more bizarre theories which I will cover later. There are 8 subterranean dwellings at the site, and each is connected by underground tunnels, as well as a workshop area. The covered passages between the homes are a little over 4 feet high, so the occupants would likely have been 4 feet tall or even shorter.
This is the only entrance to the village. And the only exit. Originally, this passageway would have been roofed over with stone slabs. The passageway is low and narrow and winding, and this is to stop the wind coming through and causing draft. On either side of the passageway, there are entrances into the individual houses. This is the entrance to the house, and it's very low. As you come into the house, you have to walk to the right, because on the left, there is this barrier. As you come into the house, you move round and come to the seat. This is where we think the father of the house would have sat. Right in close to the fire. The fire is in the centre of the house, and it was the only source of heat and light for the people here. They would have spent the evenings in the house around the fire, and they would have done all their cooking here. In this house, as well as the father, there would have been the mother and the children, and possibly granny and granddad and aunties and uncles as well. This is what we call an extended family. They would have all lived under this one roof. This was something that was common in the Neolithic or the Stone Age, but it also carried on in Orkney until the middle of the 19th century, about 1850 or so. The Stone Age people would have hunted and fished and farmed. They would have grown their own crops, and they would have used the grinder to grind the corn to make flour to make their bread. Scarabray is a village built inside a midden. A midden is garden compost and bones and pieces of pottery and pieces of shell that are all piled up together into a mound. And then when the mound has been there for a long time, they dug into the mound and then stone lined the circles that they dug into the mound, and these became the houses within the village. They planned the village from the very beginning so that there would be a passageway leading directly through the village, and then the houses would lead off from either side. The houses, therefore, were almost like being underground, and the midden, or the compost, kept them warm and kept out all the drafts from the wind in the winter. The passageway certainly was roofed over by stones, but the houses themselves, we think, would have been roofed with wooden beams, then with skins over the beams, and then possibly heather thatch or turf on top to form a lining. Okay. We think that during the summertime and during the daytime, the people wouldn't have been in the village at all, but they would have worked outside the village and, in fact, on top of it, on these areas that you can see between the houses. And that only in the winter time, when it was very cold and dark, and in the evenings, would they then go inside the houses. The village was eventually abandoned because the sand came in from the sea and filled in the houses and covered them over, preserving them. And then they were undiscovered for 4,000 years until in 1850 they were uncovered in a storm in the winter. And therefore we have the best preserved Stone Age village in Europe.
The site is missing its roof, so one can look down into the hobbit-like dwellings from above with a fascinating pattern used in each of the homes, consisting of a central fireplace, beds to either side, and what appears to be a dresser of shelves. There would have been blankets and screens made from animal skins and furs, but we have to imagine those rather than just the cold stone skeletons of the rooms. There were also large pots found which date back to around 3000 BC, used for heating malt. They germinated and heated cereal grains that ferment to produce alcohol. A few miles from Scarabray, there are multiple other Neolithic sites, including the Ring of Brodgar, a huge circle originally of 60 standing stones. It's just over the hill from the site, and it's hard to imagine how inhabitants of a small, hobbit-like community could excavate, transport, and erect such monuments so long ago. The ritual complex is among the oldest structures on the British Isles, and shows the inhabitants were well aware of the solstices and equinoxes. Another important archaeological site located near Scarabray is the Standing Stones of Stennis, dating back to 3100 BC. It was a ritual site which has long been associated with magic and the Norse god Odin, which also had astronomical significance. These megalithic structures imply that Scarabray likely housed a group of astronomer priests who were responsible for maintaining the sacred sites. While mainstream scholars reject the idea in favor of a more typical Neolithic farming village, the fact is that ancient farmers relied on astrological data which guided them on when to plant and harvest, and also lived in tune with nature, using those same yearly cycles to have festivals, rituals, and time their religious rites. There are numerous legends about this ancient race of little people. And while the majority of them are passed down through oral stories and myths from long ago, there are also people that live in remote communities, such as reservations belonging to the Lakota people, a subculture of the Sioux, which claim to have had interactions with what they refer to as little men. Here's an example from a Lakota woman from Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota.
When I first seen a Wiwila...
What's a Wiwila?
A Wiwila is...
Some woman.
No, it's a spring. Wiwila means spring. So there are men who live in a spring. And we were up the creek over here at the grandma's, and we didn't have refrigerators. So what they do is they have a crock pot about this big. That stuff that everybody fights over, their collector items. Well, we had those, and those went in the creek next to where the spring is, the cold water. So you could keep your butter and your meat and like that. It had to all be put in bread sacks to seal it because we didn't have plastic. So we went down there to get butter in here. I looked across the creek because I seen something move in here. The grass parted and here a little face appeared, about this big. And he was a real old man. And he was watching us. So I was looking at him too. And the other kids seen him and they said, "Wiwila!" And they ran. But he got scared of us. So the weeds closed and he took off running.
In light of how I started this video presentation with Greek myths about an ancient war between large cranes and people of minute stature, one can't help but wonder if it is related to other folk legends about a stork that steals a baby, small and light enough to carry off into the air, and if the infant would occasionally survive the abduction to be raised by human tribes as one of their own. Another researcher that has contemplated the existence of various races in remote antiquity, whether they be giants or little people, is Dr. Susan Martinez, who writes about a hobbit-like population no taller than 3.5 feet in height, yet perfectly proportioned, that has inhabited the earth since the remote past.
They were known as the sacred little people among some tribes. They were known as the little people of peace among other tribes. Okay, the first thing to consider is that there were immediate crossbreeding of races so that the next generation, you'll find there's a mixed type with a lot of little people genes and some Asu genes. And then the next generation, there'll be mixture of all those types. So it's just a matter of having some of those genes. But races the little people, for one thing, were mandated to live apart so that their genes would not be lost. And so in much of this history, they were a separate people. And you find this in the ethnographic record, you find this in the folklore of people's tribes all around the world who remember the little people, that they lived separately. There are little people populations on almost every continent to this day.
It turns out that, anthropologically speaking, it seems that our planet has had a far more diverse history than many of us previously believed. While I've already made several videos concerning the myths, legends, and even burial sites of an ancient race of giants that walked the earth in the past, which I'll include a link to in the description for those who'd like to see it, I've also covered in several other videos, as well as in my book Gods with Amnesia, information about a pygmy race that also called this planet home in antiquity, and in some cases, the not-so-distant past. In the early 1800s, a rash of news stories began appearing in Nashville and Middle Tennessee newspapers regarding the discovery on Middle Tennessee farms of pygmy graves. Through the process of plowing, or by erosion, farmers and landowners had discovered small graves, rustic rectangular stone boxes or sarcophagi, approximately 2 feet long, 14 inches wide, and 16 inches deep. Cherokee folklore seemed to confirm the existence of the Pygmies, with their belief in a race of little people. Curious experts came to Nashville to investigate the grave sites, examine the bones, and offer explanations. Farmers began probing their properties with metal rods, stabbing the earth in search of hard stone lids. This historic newspaper article about Tennessee Pygmy graves from Woodbury Press was republished in 1877 in the Journal of the Royal Anthropological Institute of Great Britain and Ireland, Volume 6. A Pygmy Graveyard in Tennessee. An ancient graveyard of vast proportions has been found in Coffee County. It is similar to those found in White County and other places in Middle Tennessee, but is vastly more extensive and shows that the race of Pygmies who once inhabited this county were very numerous. The same peculiarities of position observed in the White County graves are found in these. The writer of the letter says, quote, "Some considerable excitement and curiosity took place a few days since, near Hillsboro, Coffee County, on James Brown's farm. A man was plowing in a field, which had been cultivated many years, and plowed up a man's skull and other bones. After making further examination, they found that there were about 6 acres in the graveyard. They were buried in a sitting or standing position. The bones showed that they were a dwarf tribe of people about 3 feet high. It is estimated that there were about 75,000 to 100,000 buried there. This shows that this county was inhabited hundreds of years ago." This ancient pygmy race is a worldwide phenomena, both archaeologically and in myth and folklore. The Irish have their leprechauns, the Nordic people have their gnomes and elves, and many other societies and cultures share similar legends and stories. What makes these ancient burial sites in Tennessee so interesting is the abundance of articles that were published, which, like the many dozens of articles I covered regarding ancient giant skeletons discovered in the many Native American mounds, there's still a newspaper trail regarding this pygmy race, even if organizations like the Smithsonian deny their existence. This article was published in 1820 in the Nashville Whig. One of the most persistent and widely published tales about Tennessee prehistory concerns cemeteries of diminutive stone-lined graves containing the remains of a primordial pygmy race. In July 1820, the Nashville Whig published an account of these mysterious remains, describing in detail the discovery of hundreds of diminutive graves on several farms near Sparta in Wine County, Tennessee. On the farm of Turner Lane, 5 miles southeast of Sparta, on the waters of Caney Fork and Cumberland, and on other farms adjacent, have lately been found small graves sunk into the earth from 1 foot to 18 inches below the surface. They're about 10 inches broad and 18 inches long, having a flag limestone rock at each of the ends and sides, and covered with the same species of rock. In these graves are found skull bones, about 3 inches in diameter, nearly sound, the other bones being proportionately small. Between 200 and 300 of these graves have been discovered. In every tomb yet open was found a small black earthen pot, about 1 pint in capacity, containing a small conch shell, undecayed, of a gray color on the exterior and red within, and as transparent as this species of shell is usually found. The pot, when broken, exhibits numerous white specks of round shining particles. At Mr. Anderson's, 2.5 miles in southwesterly direction from the farm of Mr. Lane, were found other skeletons of the same dimensions, in tombs constructed upon the same plan and of similar materials. One at least, it is said, was observed to have teeth and all the bones belonging to the human body. Mr. Lane, who's a man of observation, gives it as his decided opinion that these are the skeletons of adult persons. He founds his opinion upon the solidity of the bones and the heads, and also upon the fact of the sutures of the skulls being entirely closed and solid. The trees growing where they were found are as of great size and age as any in the surrounding forest. The small graves at Mr. Lane's are arranged But at Mr. Anderson's, there's a large burying ground full of them without any order as to position. That the bones are human, Mr. Lane thinks, there can be no doubt, and that they are not the bones of children, he thinks unquestionable. The rocks which enclose them are thin blue limestone, and not of that neighborhood originally, all of the limestone in the vicinity being of a gray color. Here is a mystery that baffles conjecture and puts all experience at defiance. The stories of the pygmies of Herodotus on the borders of Ethiopia and the Red Sea, and those of Homer in India, have always been treated as fables, which in the days of those men entered into most of their written compositions. How could a nation of pygmy men, not exceeding 18 inches in stature, build habitations, clear the forest, cultivate the soil, defend themselves against the ravages of the hawk and eagle, the wolf and the panther? Pliny the Elder writes about an ancient war, long ago, between pygmies living around the Arctic region and cranes, large, terrifying birds, which would often steal their young, which, if true, would explain a lot of the myths about storks seen flying with a baby. He also says that the pygmies were displaced from their ancestral homeland by the unrelenting constant onslaught, locating them between Egypt and Ethiopia, but also having found refuge on the eastern part of the North American continent. Homer's Iliad also mentions a violent war between large, deadly cranes and valiant and courageous pygmies, comparing the bloody battles to the war between the Trojans and the Greeks. The pygmies were eventually fractured, reduced to refugee status, and forced into exile. Another Greek author, Antoninus Liberalis, suggested that the Greek gods engineered this conflict as punishment against an immodest and disrespectful queen of the pygmies. According to Aristotle, quote, "The cranes do this, for they travel from Scythia to the marshes in the higher parts of Egypt, from which the Nile originates. This is the place where the pygmies dwell, and this is no fable, for there is really, as it is said, a race of dwarfs, both men and horses, which lead the life of troglodytes." Troglodytes means they live in caves. Incidentally, modern African pygmies average around 4.5 feet in height, and genetic sequencing has determined that they have mixed genetics with other archaic hominin species that once lived on the continent. So they're not the same fair-skinned pygmy race depicted by the ancient Greeks, but nearly twice as tall, as the African pygmies are hybridized with one or more archaic African hominin species, most likely Homo erectus. Other clusters were said to have settled in Arctic Canada and the Himalayas and parts of Asia. It's interesting to note the discovery of the 3.5-foot fossil remains of an ancient hominin dubbed the Hobbit, which was found on an island in Indonesia, which some have speculated have also contributed genetics to modern populations. An October 2005 article published by the Circle of Ancient Iranian Studies reported finding the mummified remains of a person of small stature in Iran, which they believe was part of what they call an ancient city of dwarfs. In 2010, Live Science published an article called "Giant Storks May Have Fed on Real Hobbits," describing fossils of giant storks found in Southeast Asia, which may be empirical evidence supporting the ancient myth of the pygmy battles. As for the pygmy race that may have inhabited Tennessee, some have speculated that they have found entrances into the inner earth, large subterranean cave systems below the surface that has fresh flowing rivers filled with oxygen-producing algae, fish, and lit by glowing edible lichen and mushrooms, providing a safe refuge from the harsh conditions on the surface. It's an interesting theory, one that I can't prove, but there's no shortage of legends about the inner earth, which allegedly not only is called home by a people of a wide range of heights, from pygmy to giant, but even mammals, reptiles, and birds thought to be extinct long ago on the dangerous surface world that we inhabit. over 3,000 years old, archaeologists have spent the last 7 months unearthing what Dr. Zahi Hawass calls the most important discovery in Egypt since King Tut's tomb. The ruins of this ancient city in Luxor, located on the east bank of the Nile River, around 500 kilometers south of the capital, Cairo, is known as Aten, which is the name of the sun god, and dates back to the reign of Amenhotep III, the ninth king of the 18th dynasty, who ruled Egypt from 1391 until 1353 BC. While the city is called Golden, after the Golden Age of Egypt, there weren't any golden artifacts found there yet, to my knowledge, so it's not like an Egyptian El Dorado, but more of a metaphorical golden city. In an alchemical context, the element of gold is associated with the sun, so in that respect, the name is also fitting. The doorways are surprisingly low, and so is the ceiling. So, in my estimation, this town was not for the ancient Egyptian sun gods or nobility, but inhabited by a pygmy race, likely a worker class, which once again validates the myths and legends about this mythical branch of the human family here on Earth. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your comments. So please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.